I have a thumbs up from the back. So good morning, everybody. Nice to see plenty of familiar faces in the room and hear plenty of familiar voices, Peter. I'm delighted to sit in front of you and report another does exactly what it says on the tin set of results for One Savings Bank. I think I would categorise them as a story of continuing growth, efficiency and returns, all underpinned by a strong balance sheet and a slight uptick in terms of our core equity tier 1 capital. So we talk about the growth first of all, loans and advances up by 31% to now 5.1 billion, supported with a really strong infrastructure and operating model. Clearly the income is good, but our costs are very much under control as well, and we're delighted to report a 2% improvement in our cost to income ratio to 26%. We've also managed to keep our management expenses under control, or indeed actually tick them down a touch during 2015, despite investing in the business for further infrastructure and IT as we continue to grow. Resulted in a strong uplift in profitability, up 52% to 106 million, with an excellent return on equity of 32%. Earnings per share significantly up at 34.8 pence. And we are pleased to report, or the board will be recommending to shareholders to vote in favour of a dividend at 8.7 pence per share. So those are the highlights of the numbers. April's going to now provide you with a little bit more colour, and then we'll swing back to me and I'll give you some highlights from our operating model and our business review.
Thanks, Andy. Morning, everybody. I'd like to start with an update on progress against our... So can you just change the slide for me? Thank you. Progress against our financial objectives, and I'm very pleased to say that we met them all comfortably in 2015. We remain predominantly retail funded with a strong loan-to-deposit ratio of 96% or 93% excluding the impact of funding for lending. I'm delighted with our cost-to-income ratio of 26% in the year, an improvement, as Andy said, of 2 percentage points on the prior year and in line with the first half of 2015, despite the planned increases in core headcount and infrastructure investment in the second half, which included a new head office in Chatham, demonstrating our continued focus on cost discipline and efficiency as we grow. Our fully loaded Common Equity Tier 1 ratio strengthened to 11.6% as at 31st of December 2015, comfortably in excess of our stated target, despite significant balance sheet growth, which included the acquisition of a portfolio of second charge mortgages for £260 million in March 2015. This demonstrates the strength of our organic capital generation capability through profitability. Our underlying return on equity for 2015 was 32%, an improvement of 1 percentage point on the prior year and significantly in excess of our stated target. The board is recommending a final dividend for 2015 of 6.7 pence per share, subject to shareholder approval at the AGM in May. This gives a total dividend per share, as Andy mentioned, for the full year of 8.7 pence, representing 25% of underlying profit after taxation in line with our stated dividend policy. Turning to the key financial indicators that drove our strong 32% return on equity, I'm delighted to report an underlying profit before tax of £106 million for the year, up 52% on the prior year, due largely to the growth in the loan book and an improved net interest margin, as shown on the top right-hand chart on this slide. The bottom right-hand chart shows our efficiency metrics. The consistent Mannix ratio, which is the ratio of operating costs to total assets, demonstrates our continued focus on cost discipline and commitment to investing in line with asset growth. Further investment across the group is planned in 2016, and our new Bangalore office went live last month, so our cost-to-income and Mannix ratios may go a touch higher this year, but we will remain focused on identifying further cost efficiencies as we did in 2015. The next slide shows a comparison of the profit and loss for 2015 versus the prior year. The 18 basis point growth in net interest margin to 309 basis points reflects the lack of price pressure in our core markets and the positive impact of high margin new lending and portfolio purchases, further diluting the low yielding back book inherited from the Building Society and offsetting the roll-off of the higher-yielding personal loan portfolio, as well as a continued reduction in our cost of funds. The lower cost of funds reflects the benefit of funding under the SLS scheme and the continued reduction in the cost of retail funds as maturing fixed-term deposits rolled off onto slightly lower prevailing rates. Looking forward to 2016, I see net interest margin of around 3% as achievable, with additional benefits to come from the extension to the FLS, offsetting the drag from the roll-off of the personal loan portfolio. Total FLS drawdowns stood at £161 million as at 31st of December 2015, down from a peak of around £400 million in September, as we sought to spread the maturity profile and manage liquidity more efficiently. The Bank of England approved a new collateral pool in the fourth quarter, which we have pre-positioned and can draw down on at short notice, allowing us to manage our liquidity more efficiently. We expect to draw down an additional £500 million this year to help fund growth in the loan book and have so far drawn down £175 million of that in the first quarter. Turning to the impairment charge of 23 basis points, this improved by 10 basis points versus the prior year, reflecting a very strong performance from the front organic book, which had negligible arrears and loan losses. From more than 21,500 loans, totalling £4.2 billion of new organic origination since the bank's creation in February 2011, only 48 cases are more than 3 months in arrears, with an aggregate balance of only £5.1 million and average LTV of just 56%. Loan losses on the personal loan portfolio were lower in 2015 as the prior year included the impact of a change in methodology. The pace of growth in arrears continued to slow in 2015 and levels remain well below the initial forecasts used to price the purchase. This was partially offset by higher loan losses on acquired mortgage portfolios, although we remain pleased with the overall performance of the acquired mortgage books to date. I would expect the overall loan loss ratio in 2016 to continue to trend down due to the roll-off of the personal loan portfolio and further dilution from new origination. Finally, on this slide, we are delighted with the 10.4 pence improvement in underlying earnings per share, reflecting the overall growth and profitability of the group. Turning to the balance sheet, you can see the 31% growth in the loan book in 2015 due to strong organic origination and the portfolio purchase, partly offset by attrition in the back book and acquired mortgage portfolios in runoff. Based on our target return on equity and dividend policy, our organic capital generated from retained earnings can support loan book growth of around 20% in 2016. The loan book growth in 2015 was funded in part by drawdowns from the Funding for Lending scheme, with the balance funded by retail savings deposits. The FLS drawdowns, which are held off balance sheet as they are in the form of T-bills, form part of our liquidity portfolio and enabled us to utilise other cash deposits to fund loan book growth. Turning to capital, the increase you can see in risk-weighted assets as a percentage of total assets is primarily due to the diversification of our funding, with FLS being held off balance sheet and therefore not forming part of the total assets used in the calculation. The Common Equity Tier 1 ratio of 11.6% remains comfortably above our floor, and our leverage ratio has improved to 4.5%. Both are significantly above the end game minimum requirements. As I've highlighted in the past, our capital stack currently comprises just Common Equity Tier 1 and Tier 2 and could accommodate additional Tier 1 in the future when market conditions are favourable, so that we can achieve an optimal structure under CRD 4. We are continuing to develop our risk models as we progress towards an internal ratings-based approach for our core business lines. Turning to our segments, starting with Buy-to-Let and SME, this segment experienced strong loan book growth in 2015, with £1.5 billion of new organic origination versus £1.2 billion in the prior year. the average interest coverage ratio for buy-to-let origination during the year was 159%, demonstrating our conservative underwriting in buy-to-let. The high margin new lending, together with the falling cost of funds, drove the significant increase in net interest income you can see in the second chart to £95.1 million. The growth in net interest income in turn drove the higher contribution to profit from this segment of £89.2 million. This chart also shows the growth in the segment's gross asset yield before swaps due to the higher margin new lending. The loan loss charge as a percentage of average gross loans improved in 2015 versus the prior year from 30 basis points to 20 basis points due to dilution from the strong performance of the front book. Average loan to values remained strong at 66% at the end of the year, with only 1% of loans by value with LTVs exceeding 90%. Turning to our residential segment, the loan book increased by £244 million to £2 billion due to the portfolio purchase, as gross new organic origination was largely offset by redemptions on the back book and acquired mortgage books in runoff. However, net interest income of £69 million increased by 21% due to the higher margin organic origination, the portfolio purchase, and the continued reduction in the bank's cost of funds. The residential segment's contribution to profit increased to £60.7 million from £49.9 million after third-party servicing costs and impairment losses. Impairment losses remained low in this segment but increased versus the prior year due to the additional provisions on acquired mortgage books in runoff that I mentioned earlier. Average loan-to-values remained low at 56% at the end of the year, with 2% of loans by value with LTVs exceeding 90%. That's up from 1% in the prior period due to some higher LTV loans in the portfolio purchase. Turning to the personal loan portfolio, which we acquired from UCAR in 2013, this portfolio has a very short remaining average life and is in runoff. The gross loan book reduced from £117 million to £49 million during the year. The net interest income reduced to £5.6 million from £17.7 million, and contribution to profit of £1.3 million was down from £10.4 million in 2014, reflecting the fast runoff of the book in advance of expectation and one-off adjustments to the EIR cash flow model as the portfolio approaches maturity. This is the last time that we intend to report separately on this segment, as it will be materially gone by year-end. I'll now pass back to Andy, who will give you a recap of our strategy and talk about the outlook for the business.
Thank you. I'm just going to spend a few minutes touching on our business model. Our business model is relatively simple. We are a specialist lender. We are a retail-funded organisation with what we think is a very fair and transparent retail savings proposition, and we believe we have a relatively unique and super cost-efficient operating structure. Turning first to the specialist lending scenario, in our core markets, they continue to perform well and in some cases in excess of our expectations. We've seen through our buy-to-let and SME segment strong growth, strong affordability. We've made some changes in our criteria during the course of 2016 to cement that focus on the professional landlord. April's already touched on our interest rate coverage of 159% on our buy-to-let lending. And April's also mentioned the strong credit and arrears performance, only 48 loans out of 21,500 in 3 months plus arrears. Low loan-to-values, residential at 56%, buy-to-let at 66%, give us strong coverage in the event of any house price issues, and all of our growth underpinned by our bespoke and responsive manual underwriting. Cases are sanctioned by a trained underwriter with a clear mandate. We continue to focus on our intermediary relationships. These are key to our proposition, key to the way we leverage those distribution relationships. As I think many of you know, we're not open to the whole of the market. We focus on an exclusive team of broker partners that we work with, and I'm delighted that we're delivering a net promoter score from those brokers of 59%, which I think is something that lots of banks would kill for. We still see growth opportunity in core markets like buy-to-let. The buy-to-let market is very big, and we're only running a sort of just over 4% of flow in that market share. We think we're very good at what we do, so there's lots of headroom for us to aim at. And I'm delighted that again in 2015, by both the Personal Financial Awards and What Mortgage Awards, we won Best Buy-to-Let Lender. Growing our core and newer businesses, we've extended in our InterBay brand some of our offerings for professional commercial investors, people wanting to buy property and refurbish it before either putting it back onto the market or putting it into a rental proposition. We've targeted our lending criteria to cement our focus on professional landlords in the buy-to-let sector. We've done a big piece of work with our real estate team, the qualified RICS valuers that sit on our payroll, to work out the holding costs for a larger property portfolio, work out the benefits and the opportunity of scale that comes with a larger portfolio. And now if you come to us as a first-time buy-to-letter or a landlord with only one or two properties, you will have to provide a greater degree of rental cover and a lower loan-to-value will be offered to you versus a professional landlord where we can underwrite the portfolio and the real estate that sits in that in more depth. The new lines that we've been focusing on, our Heritable Development Finance brand, for example, has grown well during 2015 with now $172 million of loan commitments out on that business. It's an underfunded market. The big banks are focusing on the large national house builders. We all know we need to build more houses in the UK, and we're doing our bit to fund those small and medium-sized builders in that space where we like the risk and reward profile. And we're increasing the range of secured funding lines that we offer to non-bank lenders who don't enjoy the benefits of a retail funding franchise. These are secured. We have looked through onto the underlying security. Many of them are related to property, either commercial or residential. And I'm pleased that that's increased by 77% in the year to now £126 million worth of lines funded. I think it's also important to note that while we expect that there'll be ebb and flow in the purchase aspects of the buy-to-let market. Buy-to-let refinancing remains exceptionally strong. For us, it's around 59% of what we do, and we see continued opportunities with our criteria changes to target more portfolios from professional landlords to refinance in. In terms of our savings proposition, it's a very deliberate proposition. We've talked to you about that before. It's an award-winning franchise, and it continues to be core to our strategy. I'm delighted that 23,000 new savers chose to join the group during 2015, and 32,500 new customers came to our online savings platform, which demonstrates that existing customers using more traditional channels are actually finding our online platform beneficial to them. We continue to develop our product range and be recognized in a number of industry awards. We actively manage liquidity along with our ability and desire to draw under the funding for lending scheme and again have enjoyed fantastic retention on our retail savings of 89% during 2015. We are primarily retail funded. It's really important to us to remain that. And I'm delighted that for the third year in a row, the Ken Reliance brand won the best cash ISA provider. And I'm also delighted that in 2015, we won the best bank savings provider. In terms of our cost-efficient operating model, the uniqueness of our structure is that a significant proportion of our staff are based in our office in Bangalore. You have here on the slide some pictures of our new office in Bangalore. It looks very much like our offices in Kent. It's a core part of the group. They're our staff. They're part of the culture and the fabric of the business. And it's important that we leverage that and we continue to increase our leverage of the Indian operation. And we've now got the premises to really give us the scope to grow that as the business grows forward. The cost benefit is huge. Average staff cost in salary terms of £4,800 per head helps to deliver our cost-to-income ratio and our efficiency. It's important to do things efficiently and at low cost, but you have to do that with the customer in mind. And I'm delighted that our overall net promoter score from our savings customers is 55% compared to the average for the banking sector in single digits, which is a statistic we're very proud of. I think it's important to touch on some of the current market trends. Of course, we're cognizant of the political and regulatory headwinds that are there in terms of our buy-to-let market. However, we absolutely and fundamentally believe that the private rented sector remains a key plank of the UK housing structure and will have to continue to do so going forward. We focus on the professional sector who have time to plan for the changes on the personal tax regime side of the buy-to-let market. We hope that the changes to stamp duty will discourage pensioners from throwing their pot into a single buy-to-let and hoping it's their income in retirement. I think that's what it's targeted at, and I think it may put some of those people off. It's not our target market. For a professional landlord with their financing in their back pocket who's used to doing property transactions, we've already seen evidence of in offer price, and we expect to continue to see evidence of the stamp being wiped off the purchase price to enable them to be the buyer of choice, effectively, because they've got their financing in their back pocket. We've also seen one or two of our portfolio landlords or some portfolio landlords coming to us, refinancing a portfolio from their own name into a limited company, burying the fees and charges that are required to do that on the way through, and thinking about how they offset that against their capital gains tax when they eventually liquidate their portfolio. And the CGT changes in yesterday's budget, I think, are very beneficial for people who are planning to do that in the future. I think it's right that we touch on the Basel consultation paper. We believe, our house view is that it's very unlikely that the risk weights talked about in that paper will come in. Let's not forget that the current CRR says buy-to-let is already 100% risk-weighted, but the UK market performs very differently from villas in certain parts of Spain and trailer stock in certain parts of the US, and therefore the UK has a carve-out for its buy-to-let lending, and we expect that to continue. And the noises from Andrew Bailey from the Bank of England are very supportive of the cause. I think it's probably also important to say that we already have our resource on board, external resource helping us build our models for IFRS 9, and then the models that will take us through towards the IRB approach. So regardless of what happens on standardized risk weights, we expect, at least on a single product category, if something bad happens to standardized, we expect to be well advanced to turn over to the IRB capital approach. I think mortgage brokers are doing a very, very good job of increasing their market share. Lenders continue to run more and more scared of conduct regulation, which means the distribution channels through the broker and intermediary play is becoming much more important. We have very strong relationships there, and that helps us in terms of cementing our distribution. Wholesale markets are open. The FLS has been extended, which is beneficial in terms of NIM, and our retail funding platform is stable. So in terms of summary and outlook, 2015 was an incredibly strong year for One Savings Bank. We delivered plus on all of our financial objectives and a stonking ROE. I think I used that phrase last year, but it's even more stonking in 2015 at 32%. We are confident we'll continue to achieve the objectives that we've set out to the market. We have innovated and will continue to do that. We work very closely with the respective broking community in the UK to talk about product offering and how we can develop different strands of business that the big banks just aren't fleet of foot enough to do. We've entered 2016 with the strongest ever pipeline that we've had, and our application volumes are the strongest they've ever been and continue to be the strongest they've ever been. So this isn't a last-minute flurry to get your case completed before the stamp changes, because if you're applying today, there's no chance of getting a case completed before those. This is a continuing, ongoing investment by professional, commercial, and buy-to-let investors. We continue today with that strong pipeline. We remain confident of the outlook, and we remain confident of delivering on the objectives based on the strength of the niches in which we operate. Thank you very much. That's us. We are now very, very happy to take Q&A. Dan's hand was first, and then Ian, I'll come to you.
Good morning, Daniel Gareth, Barclays. Cover for me. I was wondering if you could have a bit more colour around sort of distribution trends you mentioned. Mortgage brokers proportion rising, your strong links with them. Is there any evidence of the amount of business you're writing with those mortgage brokers relative to your peers increasing or your peers retreating already from this market? And what might that mean for increased ability to increase your asset yield, say, going forward, to be the first question? And second, you mentioned by the time the Basel IV recommendations might come in, sort of 2019, 2020, have been well advanced on IRB. Can you give any more colour around sort of the process of moving to IRB from your discussions? You know, do you need a certain number of years data of how your portfolio performs? Is there ability to accelerate that? There's been talking around sort of things like slotting. Any sort of color on that?
So if I cover off the sort of peers versus brokers first, and then April, I think we'll happily cover off the Basel and the IRB points. I mean, different lenders have different distribution strategies. So, we've seen lenders who are focusing on a blend of direct distribution and distribution through brokers. We are absolutely wedded to being effectively 100% broker distributed, with the exception of our development finance business through the Heritable brand, which is actually direct to developer. So there is no broker intermediary there. We are not open to the whole of the market. We have to maintain control over the broker panel that we operate with. I think if we opened ourselves to the whole of the market, we'd flood the engine to the extent where, both operationally but more importantly from a capital perspective, we wouldn't be able to cope. We're going to continue to work with those brokers. They will naturally increase their market share as lenders become more and more concerned about the conduct risks of selling direct. You know, it wasn't very many years ago where every building society and every bank would have a proportionately fairly large sales force offering to sell you a residential home loan or a commercial mortgage or whatever it might be. Those sales forces just don't exist, and banks are continuing to pull away, choosing to allow the professional qualified brokers to do it. Our strategy is not to go direct, it's to remain broker distributed. Our relationships are key. Our net promoter score, I think, demonstrates that we're doing a pretty good job of managing those relationships, and we'll continue to focus on that methodology.
And then the possibility of the asset yield expansion? I
talked about the headwinds on buy-to-let. You know, we're not in a place that says the buy-to-let market is going to fall off a cliff. We think the buy-to-let market will remain strong in the right sectors of that market. Actually, I think one or two lenders, will start to think about complexity and so forth. We think it's a time to be strong in that market. And as we continue to evolve our professional landlord offering, brokers, I think, will increasingly place business with us that we're able to make a better and faster decision on. And we're not a price-driven lender. We're a service and criteria-driven lender, which I think is reflected in the asset yields we're earning. So we haven't moved pricing in our core markets. In fact, we ticked it up a little bit during the course of 2015, and we're not in the place where we think we have to cut pricing. Not sure how many more tick-ups we can do. And, of course, the cost of funds is pretty beneficial at the moment as well, but we don't see pressure on asset yields, Dan. I think that's probably the best way to phrase it.
And on the capital side, you're absolutely right. You know, the path to IRB is a multi-year path. We have actually been running shadow IRB for a couple of years now. I think one of the benefits, if I can say that, of IFRS 9 is that the models that we're building for that actually are very suitable and fit for purpose for IRB as well. And I think, as Andy mentioned, you know, we made sure we secured both internal and external resources to build those models early, because we do see that is going to be quite a competitive landscape. Those models are under development, and we are very focused on achieving IRB before any standardized risk weight changes are brought in within Europe. And it's very encouraging to hear the support coming from Andrew Bailey to make it easier for newer, smaller lenders to achieve competitive risk weights and capital requirements. So things that have been mooted, for example, is allowing single line IRB, just making it easier for players such as ourselves to get through that approval process. And that very positive mood music coming from the regulator gives us some additional comfort. But you're right, it is a multi-year process, but we're on that path already.
Thank you.
You are next, Sally.
Morning, thanks. Ian Gordon, Investec. Can I have three, please? Just all pretty basic ones, actually. Firstly, within the SME buy-to-let segment, the risk weight intensity has come down slightly again. I think it's come down every four halves in a row. Is that just as simple as proportionate growth in buy-to-lets being faster than the other business lines driving that average down? That then links into my second question, which is, as a result of that, CET1 is probably stronger than where most of us saw it being. You've reaffirmed your ability to grow the loan book at circa 20% from organic earnings generation, but subject to market conditions, should I not be anticipating you utilising part of that surplus capital, which is built during the course of the second half of this year? And then thirdly, just on the liability side, a bit of spoon feeding, please. You referenced the ability to be more dynamic in your liquidity management. You had exceptionally strong retail deposit growth in the second half. You've guided us to a material acceleration in, or redrawing of FLS. So that all just seems to mathematically point to a lower average cost of funds. Am I missing anything?
Okay. If I kick off on the RWAs, and then I'll hand over to April to talk about CET1 and the potential in terms of our cost of funds. So, the RWAs are down for a couple of reasons. One, because there is some dilution factor with, you know, buy-to-let being a large chunk of the book, therefore, it's, you know, there's more in the 35% risk-weighted category. But also, we've seen LTVs come in a little bit on the way through, which is also beneficial in terms of our RWAs. And less of our commercial cases are over the sort of 1 million euro mark, so there's a more advantageous RWA treatment of those. But in the round, it's predominantly a dilution effect.
The CET1 stronger. I think I've always said that, you know, the exact sort of decimal places on our CET1 ratio will very much depend on the growth opportunities we see in a period. And, you know, we do have an appetite, although our main growth strategy is, of course, organic. We've had a proven track record of closing portfolio acquisitions, so we continue to look at those. We announced a couple of small ones a few weeks ago, and just the sort of the timing of those, the growth, you know, there's no magic sort of number there. You know, it might be a tiny bit higher, it might be a tiny bit lower, just depending on that growth opportunity. So I think you hit the nail on the head there. What I would say is we're very comfortable and pleased with our Common Equity Tier 1 ratio, which I said earlier is, you know, far in excess of the minimum requirements. And we continue to be very prudent in our product pricing tool. And, you know, as our CET1 ratio goes up, we increase the requirement in the product pricing tool when we assess our ROEs. So hopefully that answers your question there. Moving on to the liability side, I don't think you're missing anything. I mean, I when I gave my NIM guidance, I did highlight that a lower cost of funds clearly is a positive factor looking forward, and that's mainly coming from the extension of the funding for lending scheme. You know, there's a tiny bit still to come on retail savings being retained onto slightly lower prevailing rates, but I think each time I meet you guys, that has sort of narrowed and narrowed. So the main significant driver is funding for lending. But offsetting that, of course, we have the drag of the personal loan portfolio. And as I said, that pretty much has gone by the end of this year. So that's the sort of the factor there. So, no, I think you're spot on when it comes to how you're talking about liabilities. And you will see that our year-end liquidity ratio was significantly lower than it was at the prior year. A couple of drivers there. If you recall, we had the pensioner bonds coming in at the beginning of 2015 on much lower, sort of much higher rates than retail savings. So we deliberately ticked up our liquidity running into that just in case. And this year end, you know, with all of this new collateral posted at the Bank of England, sort of available really on demand, we can manage our liquidity far more efficiently. And that, I think, is very much demonstrated in that liquidity ratio.
Thank you. Could I just take one more on, if I may? You mentioned IFRS 9. Nobody else has given us any help with IFRS 9. I wondered if you were able to...
They'd beat me up if I broke the pack, I think. Well, listen, you know, we're all finalising building our models, and therefore I think it would be irresponsible of me to mention any numbers, if that's what you're getting at, until those models have been completed. But we've been running our project with dedicated resources for well over a year now. We're well advanced. We're on track. And sort of looking forward to delivery later this year to allow us sort of a good period of parallel running. And I think you need to test and run these models for a period of time before you announce any numbers to the market.
Sure. Gary from here.
Hi, it's Gary at Shore Capital. I just wanted to follow up on the IRB application, because my understanding is it's not all about just building models. You've got to demonstrate that that's the way you run your business, so from a behavioural aspect. So I'm interested to understand how you go about demonstrating that. And then separate question is just on the sort of various awards that the business has won, which obviously you're rightly proud of. I'm interested really on the basis of how those awards are given. You know, is it price? Is it customer service? What is it, and how does that align to to shareholders?
So, let's talk about the IRB or the approach for risk management within the business, because that's fundamentally what it's all about. We during 2015 have had a change of senior personnel in our risk function, a positive change. We have worked very hard with our board and with external advisors to intensify our risk management framework and really make that a sort of part of the cultural fabric of the business. It heartens me to say when you have new senior joiners come into the organization and go out and meet their troops that actually things like conduct risk and credit risk and reputational risk, et cetera, are absolutely embedded into the culture of the business. And that's the key to risk management, is that that's what people do, not just what people talk about or put in a sort of pretty set of graphs or reports. And we've also spent a lot of time during the course of last year with the board absolutely nailing and granulating our risk appetite, not just from a type of business and LTV line, but actually breaking it down into quite micro components to understand where we like the risk and reward dynamic and where we don't, which then in turn finds its way into your models and your management information so that you're tracking to what you try and live and breathe on a daily basis. And therefore, that you're absolutely right. The balance between, yeah, you can have some models that churn out a number and doesn't the number look fabulous, but actually if you don't risk manage and run your business in that way, i.e. your lending policy doesn't accord to it or your underwriters are making whack decisions that don't fit, we're actually doing, I think, a very good job of joining all of those things together and working hard to continue to do that as we build that out.
The only thing I'd add there is I think you're referring to the youth test, which is why it's so important to have these models delivered this year to then give a period of time to be able to demonstrate, run them, do your sort of calibration, which is, a multi-year process. But I think we have that time and making sure we have these resources dedicated, building these models, calibrating them, running them, is clearly a very, very important part of our project.
Come back to the awards. We have shown you, we've won more than we've shown you in the deck. Some of them we're more proud of than others, because the ones that we're showing you in the deck are what I would class as genuine awards. So they're either voted for by customer, or they're about product and service consistency, or they're about sort of feedback or votes that you get from the broker and the distribution community and how your product offering is targeted and tailored to your customer proposition effectively. And so the ones we put in the pack are the ones that are exactly that, and therefore they are beneficial because they're a sort of badge that says you do what you say you do, and that's important. We also won the Moneyfax Customer Service Award separately. We didn't put that one on, but we picked that one up, but that's a 2015 and 16 award, so we'll probably sing that story a little bit next time around. Not that we like to boast at all. But, we've won a few others, which are, broadly about you had a good product that month, and that was when we were looking at the award, and we've, there are awards you can win depending on how many tables you buy at the dinner and so forth. Those aren't the ones we take pride in. We take pride in the ones that make a difference.
And any of those awards that you flagged up based on price?
The Moneyfax ones are they're not about headline price, but they are about consistency of offering. So to a certain extent on the retail savings proposition, that's key. That's what we do. You should always be able to look at your Kent Reliance savings product and go, do you know what? It's not top of the best buy table, but they're not treating me unfairly. It's not bad. So that price consistency and have you always got a good ISA proposition, etc., that's the stuff that falls into the voting category. So it's not about being top of the table for a few months. It's about whether you've got an ongoing strong proposition.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Peter, he doesn't need a mic. I'm sorry, I'm horrible to you, aren't I? But it is mutual.
No, it's just a question on M&A. You did say in your statement that you're evaluating inorganic opportunities. The question would be, are these further loan portfolio acquisitions, or would you also consider corporate acquisitions?
So the answer is yes and yes. We've done a couple of small trades so far in 2016. One of them actually was a nice one that we talked about, a structure that we were wanting to prove concept on, where we effectively take the on-risk 5% of the portfolio onto balance sheet, so that's sort of 20-odd million that we take on balance sheet, and then we master service the rest through a securitization vehicle and earn the servicing income. So actually it blends the return very strongly on that. So we've got some examples of that. We've always got a pipeline of portfolios that we look at. The market's pretty hot for portfolio acquisition, so we tend to be in a sweet spot where we've got servicing platform for it, so that gives us a cost advantage, and it's probably a little bit too small to securitize its own right, so that puts off some of the fund buyers who may overpay for it. And we've always got a pipeline of those things, and some big game hunting, of course, in the pipeline that we perhaps get into consortium conversations. So yes, we'll do them where there's an ROE hurdle and we like the underlying assets and the price is right, we'll continue to do that. In terms of platform acquisition or business acquisition, my categorization of 2015, and we looked at a few things, is it was a bit of a seller's market. You know, there was some stuff that came to market that we thought was interesting, but the price was too high. You know, stuff in the asset finance arena and one or two other areas a bit more fintech orientated. It's not the time to buy it when the multiple is where it is, not unless you've got so much sort of unused capital that you've got to do something with it. My sense is 2016 might start to swing slightly back the other way, and with the funding and the capital strength that we've got, you know, I think that enables us to take advantage when it's appropriate. So the answer is yes and yes, but with these things it's always to a certain extent opportunistic because it's got to be for sale at the right price and it's got to be in our sweet spot.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Yes.
Morning. Aaron Melmane from Macquarie. I just had a couple of questions. On your pipeline, I just wondered, you said you've got quite a good pipeline. I just wanted to know, is the mix of business between professional and amateur pretty similar to what you're writing in the H2 of this year?
Yeah. Well, actually, our 2016 pipeline is starting to we're starting to do less of the one or two property type market. That's because of the criteria targeting tweaks that we made. So we're less attractive, I think, to the non-professional landlord than perhaps we have been historically. So the pipeline is very strong in terms of professional multi-property landlord. I think the other thing we're seeing change, and I think we'll continue to see a change as the tax regime looms forward, is a significant uptick in the number of limited company portfolios or people buying into a limited company, going from 20% at the beginning of 2015 through to 40% at the end of 2015. And I think, you know, we may well see that, you know, continuing to tick up during the course of this year. So I think our proposition is targeting the kind of end customer that we're looking for, and we do post-implementation reviews on products to make sure that the kind of customer we got and what they bought it for was what we expected in the first place, and we seem to be hitting the spot on that.
And when you talked about sort of the landlord moving from a personal tax structure to one that is a corporate, how many of those deals have you seen? I mean, if you can't give a number, would you be able to also tell me about does your risk criteria change when it's a limited liability company? Would you take secured guarantees? How would you look at that?
So I can't give you a number because we don't report that number. But in terms of how does the risk and the security profile change, it doesn't, because we take a full personal guarantee from anyone who borrows in a limited company scenario. So you have individual borrower recourse. But the strength in any buy-to-let portfolio is actually underwriting the real estate. It's about the value of the property, its area, its rentability, its marketability and demand for rental property. You know, you talk to landlords and know what they're doing. They want to be within a 5-minute walk of the tube station. They don't want to be a 25-minute walk from the tube station because it's harder to charge top dollars to the tenant. So that kind of stuff finds its way into our underwriting process and keeps it very targeted.
Do you have first dibs on the rental income or...?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I mean, that for me is, I mean, I've been doing buy-to-let since, you know, before it was ever called buy-to-let, and one of the reasons I particularly like it is because in a residential situation, if you have a problem with the borrower, the last thing you want to do is turf someone out of their family home and so forth. But there comes a point eventually, if the borrower won't or can't pay, where the only recourse is to repossess the property, sell it, you know, and clear the debt. With buy-to-let, you don't have to do that because we have LPA receivership rights within our contractual terms, and we can step in and we can assume. And we have had, you know, examples of that being used for good conduct purposes, where we've had borrowers that have had one particular borrower had a cancer illness and was in hospital, and the management of the portfolio fell apart, and we got the early warning sign of one or two payments down. We stepped in as receiver, kept the portfolio being maintained and ticking over and clearing the payments, of course, and then the borrower is now kind of back, we hope, to full health, but back to health, and has taken the portfolio back from us. So that's an example of LPA receivership in a good conduct way. But, of course, if the borrower just runs off to the Bahamas, we can do that as well.
I'll just ask one more. On stress testing the portfolio, I know interest rate is not sort of an immediate risk, but I just wondered how far could you stress test the portfolio in terms of, I know you've got a 156 or something in terms of interest rate cover.
159.
Yeah, 159. I just wondered what is the interest rate that you could stress your portfolio to, and does it depend geographically, or should we be looking at that?
Do you want to talk about generic stress testing first in terms of the
book as a whole? Yeah, I mean, we run a lot of stress tests as part of our annual ICAAP process. We do a mixture of sort of implausible stresses, the sort of UK variant stress that the regulator publishes, combined with idiosyncratic stresses. And although those kind of extreme, I think, implausible scenarios do reduce profitability, we are still profitable because of the very sensible loan-to-values that we have on our books. So that's kind of the generic side of it. But, all of our businesses, whether it's residential, where we've always been an affordability tester, we've always looked at the yield curve and made sure that our customers are able to withstand interest rate rises. We do the same for buy-to-let through our rental cover requirements. We have external economists that look at predicting sort of wage inflation, rent rises that we can look at in conjunction with interest rate rises. So we feel that we do actually do a lot of sensible modelling data and stressing really on all of our core products.
And I think the other thing to mention is because we're a manual underwriter and we are genuinely a case-by-case underwriter, you can look at a borrower and their portfolio or a borrower and their particular loan request proposition. You can look at it in a different way from a one-size-fits-all blunt criteria or test, and therefore you can look at a particular piece of real estate where the rental yield might only be 115% because the landlord's got 10 or 12 other pieces of real estate where the rental cover on it is 180%, and where you've got that personal guarantee and that affordability regime, you can be much more responsive to the needs of borrowers. And some property doesn't yield a fantastic amount, but its capital appreciation potential is very strong, and so many professionals want some of that in the portfolio. Well, that in part is why we're good at looking at their portfolio in the round. So that manual underwriting piece is key to that test.
And we also do a lot of more sort of forward-looking or tracking, borrowers' susceptibility or vulnerability to interest rate rises post-origination. We work with the credit agencies. We identify any cohorts in the back book that might be more vulnerable than others. We engage with them. We talk to them about their expenditure, their income. So it's not just a case of, assessing and underwriting. It's an ongoing assessment as well.
I mean, just to add to that, we, having done that cohort analysis, we have a very small cohort of borrowers who had a certain interest, and their residential really not buy to let, but at a certain interest rate peak, we'll start to see their affordability stretch. So we do good conduct risk orientated things, like we offer them a free financial makeover through a professional third party company designed to help them, cut the cost of their household bills and just get the household cash flow in a strong position in the event that we get chunky interest rate rises. And I mean interest rate rises significantly ahead of where the yield curve is forecasting. So some of that management is not just about the credit risk, which clearly is key, but from us, that's an LTV perspective that protects us as a lender. But actually, as a good lending citizen, we also want to make sure we're protecting our borrowers as well, because that's a customer-focused piece for us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Good morning. It's David Wong from Credit Suisse. Two questions, if I may. The first, again, on the IRB and IFRS 9 project. Could you sort of give a bit of comment on the cost part of it? Have you is that part of your cost expectations in terms of implementing the project? And where could we? Obviously, you're running significantly below your cost income ratio target. But I was wondering if one would expect that to sort of pick up as you sort of implement the project more fully. The second question is on asset quality. Clearly, if you look at the fact that it's currently, you've got very low levels of impairments, that is partly, I guess, the credit environment is quite good, and partly because, as you said, you are seeing a lot of new origination, which is diluting that. I'm wondering if as the book seasons over the, say, the medium term, where might we expect, or whether you see the impairment rates to trend up to? Thank you.
Okay. Just on the cost of IRB and IFRS 9, I think some of the statistics that have been sort of published in the market are very much focused on the really large systemic banks with complex multiple systems. But yes, I mean, one of the reasons I am, you know, guiding up a touch and talking about core headcount infrastructure clearly isn't just premises, it is cost of regulation. So that's a very sensible comment. On the asset quality, clearly, yes, there is a dilution in loan loss coming from the front book. But when you look at the loan to value, sort of 56% of those cases which are in arrears, I think that's a strong metric. What I said earlier is that due to dilution, due to the roll-off of the personal loan portfolio, I do expect our loan loss ratio to track down. But to give you a sense of kind of, you know, an over the cycle, I guess, across the cycle, we have a pretty prudent product pricing model, which looks at, I would say, probably, you know, plausible stresses. And it obviously depends on loan to value, but if you sort of look at our kind of core buy-to-let residential lending, you know, what we put into our product pricing tool is around about, on average, you know, 5 basis points per annum on that front book business. Clearly, you know, second charge is higher, commercial is higher, development finance is higher, but in our sort of a core business, if, you know, that hopefully that gives you a sense of how we think about the risk.
Do we have anybody on the telephones who's posed a question?
As a reminder, that is star one to ask a question on the telephone. We currently have no telephone questions.
Okay, thank you, operator. Are there any further questions from the room? Okay, well, I wanted to say it's good night from me and it's good night from him, but that wouldn't be appropriate. So thank you very much for your time this morning, and we look forward to seeing you all again soon. Thank you.
Thanks.